From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the debate over military action against Iraq. We talk with journalist Thomas Ricks, who covers the Pentagon for The Washington Post. He'll discuss the threat Saddam Hussein poses, the various military options under consideration, and the differences of opinion within the Pentagon and the Bush administration. Also, we consider the Pope's ailing health. Many people are speculating about the possibility he might resign. We talk with Father Thomas Rees, editor-in-chief of America, the Catholic Weekly, about the historic precedents for a Pope stepping down, and what could be done should Pope John Paul II become incapacitated. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. President Bush went to Mississippi, the home state of WorldCom, today to declare that corporate fraud will not be allowed to undermine the economy. From public radio in Mississippi, Scott Phillips reports.
President Bush made his first trip to Mississippi today since being elected. The president spoke at a Mississippi high school not far from WorldCom's headquarters. He says his corporate fraud task force will go after wrongdoers who betray the trust of investors and employees.
They're investigating, arresting, and will soon be prosecuting. For corporate leaders found guilty of fraud and theft, there'll be no more easy money. Just hard time.
The president was in Mississippi to help raise campaign dollars for Congressman Chip Pickering, who faces Democratic Congressman Ronnie Schaus in a central Mississippi race that could help determine the balance of power in the House of Representatives. For NPR News, I'm Scott Phillips.
On another topic, the president said in Mississippi today, there is no question the U.S. will respond in some way to Iraq, but did not specify whether it would be a military strike. The president says Congress and U.S. allies would be consulted. The Bush administration believes Iraq has biological, chemical, and other weapons of mass destruction. In a rare courtroom victory for advocates of regulating political money, a federal appeals court today upheld a Vermont law that restricts not just contributions to candidates, but spending by the candidates as well. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Since 1976, the Supreme Court has approved limits on campaign contributions, saying that the government has a strong interest in preventing corruption. But when it comes to spending by candidates, the court has said that free speech is more important. Vermont challenged that concept in 1997 with a law that restricts how much gubernatorial candidates can spend. The law was challenged by the Vermont Right to Life Committee, State Republican Committee, and others. Now the federal Second Circuit has ruled that Vermont's spending restrictions are valid. The court says the limits are narrowly defined and do serve a strong government interest, safeguarding Vermont's democratic process from what it called the corrupting influence of excessive and unbridled fundraising. The circuit court ruling is expected to end up at the Supreme Court. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Enclone Chief Executive Officer Samuel Waxill has been indicted on insider trading charges. He was arrested in June. His lawyers have met with prosecutors for months to try to work out a plea agreement. Waxill is accused of tipping off friends and relatives to sell Enclone shares before it was announced that the Food and Drug Administration turned down approval of a new cancer drug made by Waxill's biotech company. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 182 points, or more than 2%, to close at 84.56 in heavy trading of 1.5 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite closed up 21. This is NPR. The California-based company Fax.com has been fined nearly $5.4 million by the Federal Communications Commission for sending unsolicited faxes to businesses and consumers. It is the largest fine ever leveled by the FCC under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. It also is the first time a so-called fax broadcaster has been fined. The Xerox Corporation is being sued by a group of its employees. The workers are charging racial discrimination. Shelley Hassman-Kaddish of member station WSHU reports.
The lawsuit is the result of an investigation by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The federal agency that investigates discrimination complaints found that black workers at three Xerox facilities in Ohio were subjected to a racially hostile work environment. The workers complain of racial jokes and slurs, intimidation, and unfair firing practices. A spokesman for Xerox says the company held its own investigation into the complaints and found no evidence of discrimination. Lawyers for the workers say they plan to file suit on behalf of about 300 present and former employees in the next few weeks. For NPR News, I'm Shelley Hassman-Kadish in Fairfield, Connecticut.
As Colombia's president-elect was about to be sworn in today in Bogota, three explosions went off, killing 12 people. At least 20 others were hurt. President Alvaro Uribe has vowed to crack down on leftist rebels and drug traffickers. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says one American was injured while patrolling the southern Afghan city of Khost. General Richard Meyer says there were gun battles in eastern Afghanistan as well. He says U.S. Special Forces came under fire and returned fire, killing four enemy fighters. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at www.fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Last week's Senate hearings on Iraq were the first public discussions in Washington about a possible military strike against Saddam Hussein. The Bush administration's plans for a so-called Iraqi regime change have been surfacing in the media over the last few months in a series of leaks from officials at the White House and the Pentagon. Following a briefing this week of President Bush and his national security team on scenarios for a military action, a White House spokesperson confirmed that while the president's views on Iraq are clear, he had reached no decision. We've invited Thomas Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post, to talk about Iraq today. He covers the Pentagon and has reported on U.S. military activities in a number of conflicts, including Somalia, Bosnia, Kuwait, the Persian Gulf, and Afghanistan. He's also the author of A Soldier's Duty, a novel about U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan. We spoke yesterday about the perception many Americans have that the plans for an attack on Iraq have come too far, too fast.
Well, I don't think we've gotten that far that fast, actually. I think what happened is a debate that had been bubbling for months inside the Pentagon and inside the administration burst into public view over the last several weeks. I really don't think they have made any decisions about whether to do it or really how to do it, but they have kind of refined some of the options. I think they're not going to go for either the very small plan of just special forces and air power or the very large plan of 250,000 troops. Why do Saddam Hussein now? What's the immediate danger? That's part of the debate. A lot of people in the military say he does not present an immediate threat, that when they look at the basic questions about Saddam Hussein, they don't see him playing footsie with terrorists. They don't see him presenting an immediate threat to his neighbors. They don't see him acquiring long-range missiles or nuclear weapons. And those are kind of the four tripwires. The other side of the argument says that's foolish. As Richard Pearl, a Pentagon advisor, said to me recently, that's pre-September 11th thinking. They're saying, the hawks are saying, don't wait for Saddam Hussein to show you that he can hit Israel or other American allies, or even America, with weapons of mass destruction, whether chemical or biological, that don't give him the chance to prove that, because once he does, you're in terrible shape. And it is clear that Saddam Hussein would like to acquire nuclear weapons, and the estimates are between 3 to 10 years.
So who comes down on what size? What is the civilian leadership pushing, and what does the Pentagon advocate?
The scorecard is kind of odd. The real hawks in the administration, as I can figure out, are the Vice President, Richard Cheney, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and some of the people around them, Cheney's staff, which is unusually influential for a Vice President's staff, and Rumsfeld's staff, the civilians at the top of the Pentagon. On the other side, I am told, are Secretary of State Powell, himself a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, which gives him some interesting connections to the Pentagon, and CIA Director Tenet. Now, the person I didn't mention in this equation is the president, George Bush. Now, the president has indicated he really wants to see Saddam Hussein gone, but he's also repeatedly said that they're looking at a variety of tools, diplomatic, military, and other being a code word for covert operations, intelligence operations. So where Bush comes down, I think ultimately will have a huge effect on this debate. If he says, it goes to Congress and says, I want to do this, that will really tip it. But so far, I think he really has not shown his hand.
Iraq has been showing some willingness in recent days in resuming weapons inspections. And so far, the Bush administration and Congress has dismissed the overtures pretty much out of hand. What are your sources telling you about whether there's anyone in Washington or the UN making the case that Hussein should be given another chance?
Well, I think he'll be given another chance, quote unquote, on inspections. They'll go through a diplomatic fan dance because actually the inspections can be very useful to the United States in providing the cause to go to war, to show the world that he is in violation of UN sanctions.
So that would be a strategic move.
Yes. The question on inspections is, would an inspection regime useful enough to really show you what's going on with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq be agreed to by Iraq? The U.S. government says no, that any inspection regime that actually would be worthwhile would be so intrusive that Iraq won't permit it. But I think they're going to have to play that out this fall and demonstrate that to the world. And I think they really have Saddam Hussein in the corner. What they'll do is go in and they'll look for, have weapons inspections that actually really try to find out where his biological weapons are, how much he has, where his chemical weapons are, and so on, whether he still actually has Scud missiles, long-range missiles, hidden away somewhere. And then when the weapons inspectors reach a point of confrontation, perhaps are kicked out or withdrawn by the UN, which says it can't carry out its work, that gives you the excuse, as it did in 1998 with Operation Desert Fox, which is a four-day bombing campaign kind of overshadowed by the Clinton impeachment mess at the time, that the U.S. military believes really had a very damaging effect on Saddam Hussein's war machine.
Let's talk about the various military approaches that are being put on the table. One that you write about is called aggressive containment. That's a scenario put forth by the top military brass. What does that mean?
It's kind of interesting here. The military assessment is that the current policy of aggressive containment is working. Aggressive containment is kind of containment plus. It's more than the old U.S. strategy of trying to contain the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Remember, for the last 10 years, the United States has been flying warplanes over Iraq almost every day in the two no-fly zones, southern Iraq and northern Iraq, to take a pretty big chunk of that country. In addition, we've had U.S. Navy ships at the top of the Persian Gulf helping enforce U.N. sanctions on Iraq. We also have had U.S. troops in the region for the last 10 years. On an average day, perhaps 25,000 troops in the region, many more right now because of the war in Afghanistan. And the U.S. military's argument, this is not universal, but it's very strongly held, especially at the top of the Army, is he is contained. He is not a threat to his neighbors, and he understands this, that if he crosses one of those bright lines, trying to get nuclear weapons, long-range missiles, or playing footsie with terrorists, that he will get whacked and whacked hard. Their assessment is he understands that, and he's standing back from those tripwires. He's not being provocative in that sense. The second big argument out there is the response to that. The civilians in the administration, the hawks in the administration, are saying, no, 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 that's foolish. All it is a fool's paradise because you don't know what's going on in Iraq. You don't know what secret dealings he's had with terrorists, nor do you know how close he really is to having a nuclear weapon. And the civilian response, as one said to me, is, look, if the military's wrong, and containment is actually not working, and it is actually giving him cover to threaten us, we could wind up losing a city, an American city. If we're wrong, all it means is we have a messy war with a messy aftermath. So their argument is the military might be right, but the consequences of being wrong are much larger than actually going in and removing Saddam Hussein. So they say, why not go in and remove him? We all know he's a bad guy. The only question is how far away is he from being threatening?
What military strategy are they putting forth, or are they championing? A smaller, faster approach?
Well, the military, the top of the military says, don't even invade Iraq. This is not universal. There are some hawks within the Air Force. I'm told the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, actually, Richard Myers, the senior officer in the U.S. military, really does think it would be a good idea to invade Iraq. But a lot of other top generals, especially in the Army, think it's a very bad idea. And one reason for that is at the top of the Army, they look around and say, okay, what's going to happen here is the Air Force would bomb for a few days. the Marines would come and go in 30 days, as is the Marine posture for how it operates. The Navy would fly a few aircraft off of carriers and then go home, and the U.S. Army would be left holding the bag. And that's really the biggest single issue right here in this debate about Iraq, is the aftermath. Nobody thinks invading Iraq would be that hard. The question is the aftermath. And in fact, a lot of the discussions of the military options have to do not so much with how to obtain victory, but how to obtain victory in a way that best shapes the post-war environment.
My guest is Washington Post reporter Thomas Ricks. He covers the Pentagon and has been reporting on the debate in Washington over a possible attack against Iraq. We'll talk more after a break, Tom. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Washington Post military correspondent Thomas Ricks. We're talking about the debate in Washington over a possible military operation in Iraq. What is the thinking about any likely successor to Hussein? Why would we think a successor would be any better than he is?
Well, the State Department is poking around that right now, and it's not even clear exactly how you'd get to a successor. If you think it's hard in Afghanistan, where we really still have a big problem, how about a country where you have Kurds in the north, Shiites in the south, and Sunnis in the middle, and their religion and ethnicity are kind of at odds? Would you get some sort of triumvirate government? What sort of promises would you make to the Kurds? There is no clear successor at this point that would be acceptable to Kurds, to Shiites, to Sunnis, and to Americans.
And how is the administration and the Pentagon weighing the factors of whether the Iraqi people would welcome U.S. forces or oppose their arrival?
It's a good question again, and this is actually another major point of debate. How exactly would the Iraqi people react? The U.S. Army, wanting to err on the side of caution and protecting their own troops, says don't make any wild assumptions that the Iraqis are going to welcome you. And so they're saying that's why you need so many troops. Couple hundred thousand. At the other end, the hawks, civilian hawks at the top of the administration are saying, no, the Iraqi people, as soon as they know Saddam Hussein is really going to go, would welcome you with open arms. And the Army's response to that has been, well, you're not going to be out there actually answering the question on the ground. We are. We want to be protected.
Can you give us a sense how divisive this debate is? I mean, are you seeing signs of strain between the Pentagon and the White House or within the Pentagon itself?
I cover the Pentagon. I don't cover the White House, so I don't have a really good sense of where the tensions and stresses are internally at the White House. At the Pentagon, it's quite startling to me how deep and divisive this argument has become. Several senior officers have told me that relations between the top of the military, the top brass, and the civilian leadership of the Pentagon is worse than they've ever seen.
Well, what do you attribute this to? That you would find it startling now? Why this question?
I'm startled that the U.S. military seems to feel so strongly that invading Iraq is not the wisest course at this point. I'm startled because it's been conventional wisdom within the U.S. military that they didn't finish the job in 1991 and that some sort of confrontation with Iraq was inevitable, that it would come sooner or later. This has sort of been something that they've war-gamed, they've thought about for a long time. I think, though, that the military is saying, wait a second, we haven't been given a clear reason as to why this has to happen now. And the military also, I think, has been very surprised to see the administration talking so aggressively about Iraq without trying to engage the American people. Remember that the generals today were the younger officers of the Vietnam War. Of the late Vietnam War. And one of the things that's been taught in the U.S. military for the last 20 years is never go to war again without the support of the American people, without the informed consent of the American people. And some of the leaks, I think, over the last month out of the Pentagon were intended to kind of jumpstart the debate, to send a rocket up to Congress. Hey, guys, pay attention here. The administration's talking about invasion. Wake up, Congress. Ask some questions.
So have your military sources expressed puzzlement over why the administration is so intent on a military confrontation in Iraq?
Yes, deep puzzlement. Something was said to me recently I'd never heard before. A general who's involved in the Afghanistan war said to me, you know, Tom, all I can figure out is there's something personal, something psychological for the president, that somehow he wants to get even with Saddam Hussein for trying to kill his father, which the U.S. government believes happened shortly after Bush stepped down as president with a assassination attempt on a first President Bush's visit to Kuwait. I'd never heard that sort of comment before from a senior military officer, you know, casting doubt on the president's motives. That's really something the U.S. military is trained not to do. That's seen as unprofessional.
Do you see evidence that the administration's determination to depose Hussein is part of a larger strategy of moving away from containment and those old Cold War strategies of deterrence towards a new policy of preemptive attacks against terrorists and hostile states, what President Bush presaged in his State of the Address? Is that what we're dealing with here?
Well, I think we are dealing with two things here. I think preemption, yes, there are people in the administration who have long thought that the old Cold War stance of deterrence doesn't work with people who really can't be deterred, which is a terrorist who have no territory or people to defend. And so that if these people have weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, or biological, that you better get their weapons before they come after you. The second thing that's going on here is the context of the Mideast. There are some people in the administration who think there is a big opportunity here to reshape the entire Mideast, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and finally Israel. And this is actually the three-cushion shot you hear used in Washington shorthand. The road to Riyadh begins in Baghdad, it ends in Jerusalem. And the notion there is, okay, get yourself a oil-exporting, friendly regime in Iraq. That enables you to pressure the Saudis to change more, to not support terrorism as much. And that takes a lot of the fuel out of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. Now, that's a real stretch and greeted very skeptically by many people in Washington, but some people in the administration are arguing that line now.
In Senate hearings last week on a military action against Iraq, weapons experts testified about the country's capabilities and Hussein's intentions. What assessment did they give of Hussein's arsenal? And what does the military know about what he really has?
They were really all over the place, with some people saying, oh, he might have nuclear weapons soon, and others poo-pooing that. This is actually one of the things that's driving the entire Iraq debate. It's not a debate about what we know. It's a debate about what we don't know. And the unknowns are very large. Nobody can really give you an assurance that this is where he is at on nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. The bottom line for the U.S. military is, we think we've been doing a pretty good job of containing this guy for the last 10 years. We've more or less been at war with this guy for the last 10 years. The last 4 years, we've been bombing Iraq every week. And for them, the bottom line is, he's got some stuff squirreled away, some biological and chemical weapons, certainly. But he doesn't have the missiles with which to deliver them. The intelligence community's assessment is that he has between 0 and 24 Scuds, which is to say medium-range ballistic missiles, that are capable of hitting neighboring countries, including Israel. But that none of those missiles are assembled right now. And some people in the U.S. military think that they are not operational at all, that it would take him quite a while to get those missiles together. But here again, I'm using the word belief. This is a faith-based argument. What do you believe about what he has? There are no real concrete solid facts here.
Judging from the congressional hearings, do you see similar divisions in Congress similar to the ones that you see in the Pentagon on the issue of military action in the coming months?
Congress is kind of an interesting player on this because two of the people that I think this administration fears most are the two people who really had an effect during the last presidential election, and that's John McCain and Joseph Lieberman, two senators. I think they really make this White House think twice when they see those guys. The interesting thing here, though, with those two is that they're both very hawkish on Iraq. I've watched them personally on a trip to Europe that I took with them last February, and they really were banging the drum for the State of the Union address and saying, look, take this president seriously. The United States is going to do something about Iraq. So they're kind of almost both of them to the right of the administration on Iraq and giving the administration a lot of cover. So the administration is kind of protected there. The administration looks rather cautious and dovish next to McCain and Lieberman.
There is some speculation among the public and many circles about whether President Bush would make a strike against Hussein without seeking the assent of Congress. What do your sources tell you about that scenario?
Not a whole lot. The question here is, what exactly does preemption mean? The president laid this out in a talk at West Point in June, in which he said the United States reserves the right to hit out at weapons of mass destruction before the threat fully materializes. Well, read that. What does that mean? Before the threat fully materializes means before there's concrete evidence. So if the president means what he said in that speech of preemption at West Point, then yeah, I think there is a chance that we could all wake up one morning and find out that there was some sort of lightning strike last night by U.S. aircraft to take out known biological and chemical weapons in Iraq. And I'm sure that they could find lawyers who would write up, you know, the reasons for that and say this was a clear and present danger. I think it would put the president out on fairly thin ice with Congress if it went badly. Congress is a very political organization. It's the essence. And they would kind of just, I think, reserve judgment and say, okay, George, you've rolled the dice here. Let's see if it works.
What timetable are we talking about here? What timetable has the military put forth?
Conceivably, it could be as early as October. More logically, sometime next spring. But I know people in the military who said, not going to happen this year. Maybe 2003, maybe 2004, maybe never.
Thomas Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll continue our conversation about plans for a possible military action against Iraq in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, MD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the press and the Pentagon. We continue our discussion with Thomas Ricks, who covers the Pentagon for The Washington Post. Also, the debate over whether Pope John Paul should resign. We talk with Father Tom Rees, editor-in-chief of America, the National Catholic Weekly.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our discussions about plans for a possible military strike against Iraq with Thomas Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. Ricks covers the Pentagon and has reported on U.S. military actions in Somalia, Bosnia, the Persian Gulf, and Afghanistan. He's also the author of a novel, A Soldier's Duty, about a U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan, published in 2001, 4 months before the invasion. Now, virtually all of the discussion until right about now among Bush administration officials and in the Pentagon, of course, in the past 6 months about what to do about Saddam Hussein has been going on behind closed doors, and we've been reading about it in the papers. Could you help us understand the relationship between you all and the press corps and the Pentagon? What unspoken rules exist about what degree of detail you can go into in your stories on these military plans?
I can't speak for other reporters. My paper has a policy of, before we publish, of checking with authorities and saying, look, if this is what we intend to publish, do you have any concerns about its accuracy or concerns about its publication endangering U.S. troops? If they say, yes, we think it might endanger U.S. troops, then I pass the phone to my bosses, the editors of the Washington Post, who have conversations about it, and they don't give the government any sort of right to stop publication, but they'll discuss it and say, is there any way we can work around this issue here? When we did that a lot during the Afghan war with various information we had. Why is this stuff all coming out now the way it is something as a person, as a reporter, as a citizen, it kind of intrigued me, and I get a lot of questions about it from friends. I think that this administration has kind of backed into a situation here where Rumsfeld, Cheney, Bush, the whole top of the security apparatus in this administration, the national security people, doesn't like to submit itself to questioning. I think whether from Congress, whether from reporters, or even, I'm told, from their own subordinates. Their attitude frequently, at least their body language, seems to be, don't call us, we'll call you, we'll let you know when we're ready to talk about this. And I think you can get away with that in smaller policy questions, but when you start talking about war, that sets off alarm bells in the rest of the administration, especially in the U.S. military. Again, here I turn to the Vietnam War. The U.S. military is determined never to march off again to war without the American people behind it. And it's striking to me that in the whole lineup of the administration, perhaps the most dovish, the most skeptical of talk of invading Iraq is the U.S. military itself, the senior uniformed leadership. I think Colin Powell is no great fan of invading Iraq, but I think the State Department is kind of skeptical. But it really is the uniformed military that's hard over in questioning it.
Secretary Rumsfeld has asked the FBI to investigate leaks of classified planning options for an invasion of Iraq, and he's been complaining about an article in the New York Times on July 5th. Why has that article, that single article, raised his ire?
It's not unusual for Rumsfeld to complain about leaks. This is, I think, something he does about every 6 months, just bang the gong and remind everybody, that you're not supposed to leak. Rumsfeld really seems to me to like to control information. I've had complaints about this from people in the military that he thinks he's the only person who can release information at the Pentagon. And he has played an unusual role here, whether or not you think that military assertion is true. If you compare him to the Gulf War, Rumsfeld is playing several of the roles that were played by other people in the Gulf War. Now, in the Gulf War, Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense, but he was not the department spokesperson. That was Pete Williams, and Pete Williams was the face of the Pentagon. But it's Rumsfeld who has done well over, I think, 100 briefings at this point on the war. Now, my personal opinion is he looks good. His body language is very credible, but I don't think he's disclosed really a single useful fact about the Afghan war in all those briefings. Most of the salutary facts we know about the Afghan war, the things for which the war will be remembered, were not disclosed by Rumsfeld. So I think Rumsfeld doesn't like to disclose information very much, doesn't like other people to disclose it, and is pretty careful about letting it out himself. And I think every few months he likes to remind people of that.
What do you find most, I guess, unusual about the evolution of the debate about Iraq compared to other military buildups you've covered, and what it says about the relationship between the Pentagon and the president?
I'm not sure what the relationship between the Pentagon and the president is at this point, but I'll tell you that the relationship between a large part of the top of the U.S. military and the civilian leadership of the Pentagon, Rumsfeld and the people around him, is very sour at this point. And it's not just policy-driven. I think it's also stylistic. The Rumsfeld you see in the briefing room sort of taunting reporters and maybe slapping them around verbally a bit is, I'm told, the same Rumsfeld with the top generals. At least he's an equal opportunity put-downer. Actually, a military officer was saying to me recently, it was kind of fun watching him slap around the reporters for a while until we realized that we're going to get the same treatment. And I think the military attitude is, look, fella, we spent the last 30 years here serving our country. These are the senior officers. We didn't go off into the private sector and make millions upon millions of dollars like some people, as they say, as they look at Rumsfeld. We were here serving our country, and we deserve your respect. And they frequently don't feel respectfully treated by Rumsfeld. Also, the complaint you get from some of them is that Rumsfeld cuts off disagreement. And now the response I get from other people is, yeah, you just have to disagree vigorously. He likes dissent. He likes an argument. But the top brass's complaint is, once Rumsfeld knows you disagree with him, you don't get invited back into the discussion.
The military had a contentious relationship at best with former President Clinton. How would you characterize the relationship the Pentagon has with President Bush?
I think that the uniform military's relationship with President Bush sort of tracks the stock market over the last couple of years. People in the military were very outspoken about their support for Bush. I would guess that 95% of the officer corps probably voted for Bush, though, of those who voted. They've been kind of shocked, stunned, disappointed. I hear a lot of bitter remarks about the president coming privately out of top military people at this point.
What are they bitter about?
They don't feel well treated, they don't feel well understood, and frequently they don't feel well respected. The relationship with Rumsfeld is getting kind of tough. They see some weapons programs cuts coming up in a couple of months that very much bother them. They don't feel that their voice is being listened to. I'm even hearing some nostalgia for President Clinton. That Clinton guy wasn't so bad, you know. He let us have our way. Now, of course, what I'm hearing from the other side, the civilian leadership and some people in the military, is, hey, the Clinton people were so terrified of the military, they let them do whatever they wanted. Basically, the military dictated, this is stuff we'll do, this is stuff we won't do. And that they haven't really had good civilian control for a decade. And this is the friction you're seeing, I'm told by these people, is the friction that occurs when you have civilian control reinserted over the military.
It's interesting that your novel, A Soldier's Duty, was about the military's reluctance to intervene in Afghanistan. So you were thinking about this issue that we're facing now, only you just got the country wrong.
Yeah, right argument, wrong country. In the novel, I looked at the U.S. military trying to resist intervening in Afghanistan. As it turned out, they were actually quite happy to invade Afghanistan. But the argument that I had in A Soldier's Duty, you're now seeing play out over Iraq, where you have an administration very eager, apparently, to go into a country, and the U.S. military saying, hold on, time out, let's really talk this through. What does this entail? What are the consequences, both for us as an institution and for the nation? And bottom line, we're not going anywhere unless we see the American people behind us.
Well, Thomas Ricks, I really want to thank you for joining me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thomas Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post. Coming up, could the Pope resign? This is Fresh Air. Pope John Paul II has survived an assassin's bullets, a broken hip, painful arthritis, four operations, and the debilitating symptoms of Parkinson's disease. During his recent visits to Canada, Guatemala, and Mexico, the Pope's increasing frailty was clear in his at times faltering speech and labored movements, and has renewed speculation among officials of the Catholic Church about whether he should resign. My guest today is Father Tom Rees. He's the editor of the national weekly Catholic magazine America and the author of several books about the Catholic Church, including Inside the Vatican. I asked Father Rees if church law provides an argument for whether an aging or ailing pope should resign.
Well, I think first we have to make clear that it is possible and is quite legitimate for a pope to resign. That is provided for in canon law. Now, we've had very, very few popes that have resigned. Historians estimate that only about 10 popes actually did resign. The last one was Pope Celestine V way back in the 13th century. So it's a very, very rare occurrence, and I think that the Pope is staying in office because he believes it's God's will for him to continue on, to continue working, and to ignore the pain that he is experiencing. But at the same time, I believe that, you know, this is a pope who's always done what he felt was God's will for him and for the church. And if he comes to the conclusion that it's God's will that he step aside, then that's exactly what he will do.
There is a danger with Parkinson's of slow progression, of diminishment of mental functioning. What happens if the pope becomes mentally unfit to rule? Does Catholic canon law address this situation?
No, it doesn't. This is a very serious lacuna in canon law. We don't have anything like the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which provides for the replacement of the president if he becomes incapacitated. We have nothing like that in church law. And it's become a more serious problem in the 21st century, when medicine can keep the body alive for much longer time than the mind really is capable of functioning and working. I mean, the nightmare of canon lawyers is if the Pope has a stroke or the Pope simply is not able to communicate or to function. What do we do? There's all sorts of theories out there about what could be done, but we don't really know. There is some hope that the Pope might have written a secret document that would be released if he ever did become incapacitated, which would say then what should be done. There's some speculation about that, but there's also been a lot of denial that that is in fact happened.
It would seem a responsible thing to do to prepare a resignation letter to be made public in the event of his total disability. But who's to judge when that point is reached?
Well, that, of course, is the problem. And that's the problem that the Vatican has always faced. They want to leave this up to the free decision of the Pope, because, after all, they don't want a bunch of people just, you know, who don't like what the Pope is doing, getting together and say, oh, the Pope's crazy, so we will remove him from office. That's obviously is something the church would not want to happen. But at the same time, you know, we have to figure out how to deal with this in some way. And so far, it hasn't been dealt with. I think that there could be set up a system, for example, if the Pope became incapacitated, if he couldn't respond to questions either verbally or in writing, then I think it would be a good idea to have a procedure that, say, the College of Cardinals would come together and vote and say, you know, we believe that the Pope is incapacitated and can no longer govern. And perhaps we could have that decision ratified by all the bishops in the world. And if a majority of the cardinals and a majority of the bishops in the world voted and said that the Pope is incapacitated, then we could have another conclave. Something, you know, some procedure like that, I think, could be legislated, but so far it hasn't been.
This must have come up before in the history of the Catholic Church. In the past, when you had senile pontiff, what did the Church do?
Well, in the bad old days, they poisoned him. In the good old days, they just, you know, put him in a back room and lock him up, and the cardinals would run the church until he died. You know, we just can't get away with that today. You have to remember that 300, 400 years ago, the role of the Pope in the church was much more limited than it is today. It would take, people in London months and months to find out that the Pope was even dead and that there was a new Pope, because the communications were so slow. Today, the Pope has a much bigger role in the Church, in the appointment of bishops, for example, and has a very visible role as a pastor. We just can't operate like they did in the old days. With NPR and CNN watching, you can't lock the Pope up in a back room and then just continue to run the church as if nothing happened. So I think we need to have some kind of procedures. The other thing is, of course, in the old days, in the bad old days, when you brought the doctors in to treat the Pope, they were much more likely to speed him to his eternal reward than they were to keep him alive. Scientific medicine is so much better today than it was a couple hundred years ago that we face this problem today. But, you know, on a more serious note, however, I mean, we have had popes that became psychologically, you know, unhinged. And they caused devastating problems in the church.
Like who? Who are we talking about?
Well, Urban VI, for example, when he was elected in 1378, I think most historians believe that his election just unhinged him. He became very neurotic and suspicious and paranoid. The cardinals that supported him deserted him. Cardinals actually got together and elected another pope. And this caused what is referred to as the Great Western Schism that went from 1378 to 1417. And we had two, three, four popes running around in Europe claiming that they were the legitimate pope. Well, this caused absolute chaos in the church. And this is, of course, the last thing that we would want to happen. And this is why we should have some kind of procedures in the Catholic Church to deal with this. But I think part of the problem is that the cardinals really don't want to go in and tell the Pope he has to deal with this.
So what is known about what aides or his colleagues have said to the Pope about this issue? Whether they've appealed to him to step down?
I don't think anyone has appealed to him to step down. There's been no evidence that any high-ranking Vatican official or cardinal has said that. If they have, they've said it very privately to him and never said anything about it elsewhere. There's no cardinal has called for the resignation of the Pope. No Vatican official has. In fact, they all keep saying that he should stay on. Now, whether or not people are bringing up that, he really needs to provide some procedures here to deal with possible eventualities, that's the real question. And whether he has done that or not is the real question that there's speculation about.
What happens when a pope resigns? What's the procedure?
Well, of course, we haven't had that happen since 1294 when Celestine V resigned. He just resigned and went off to the desert. He wanted to be a hermit. He hated being pope. He was a terrible manager. He was a very holy man, and people had hoped that he would reform the Catholic Church at a time when it really needed reform. And sadly, he wasn't up to the job. Reformers were very disappointed. Dante, for example, when he wrote the Inferno, consigned Celestine V to the Inferno, to hell, in his Divine Comedy. Today, if a pope resigned, I mean, he just writes out a letter of resignation, gives it to the cardinals, and says goodbye. And that's it. And then they call a conclave and elect a new pope.
My guest is Father Tom Rees. He's the editor of the Catholic magazine America and the author of a number of books about the Catholic Church, including Inside the Vatican. Father Rees, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Father Tom Rees is my guest. He's the editor of America, the national weekly Catholic magazine. So let's talk about choosing the next pope. What factors come into play?
You know, we as Catholics believe that the Holy Spirit is going to play an important role in the next conclave when the cardinals gather together. But the Holy Spirit has to act through human beings. There will be, you know, approximately 120 cardinals from all over the world who will gather together in the Vatican. They'll go behind closed doors 15 to 20 days after the death of the Pope. They get this conclave going very, very quickly. What will be the issues that they'll be thinking about? I always go back to Tip O'Neill's comment that all politics is local. I think that there's a lot of local issues that each cardinal will be concerned about, depending on what part of the world he comes from. I think cardinals coming from the United States and Europe are going to be very concerned that the next pope be someone who women will like. Even if he doesn't change the church's teaching, will be someone that women can relate to, that they feel is listening to them and concerned about their issues. They'll also want somebody who will be very positive on ecumenism and on continuing to improve relations with the Jewish community. On the other hand, you know, somebody from Africa is going to be much more concerned about the impact of globalization of the economy on his people. He's going to want somebody who's very, very vocal on social justice issues, that's going to call for forgiveness of third world debt, the kinds of things that John Paul II has done. And if they're living, you know, if a cardinal's from an area which is lots of Muslims, he's going to want a pope that's not going to, at a minimum, not say stupid things like, let's have a Christian crusade, as President Bush did, you know, that would never use a word like crusade in public, but would at the same, you know, would in fact want to improve relations with between Catholics and Muslims, but at the same time stand up for the rights of Catholics. So, that, you know, there are different issues around the world that the cardinals will be interested in.
Are there front runners? I mean, who is popable? And I'm not making that up. That's an Italian slang term, right?
Yes. It's, of course, very, very difficult to predict until the Pope actually dies, because I feel that age is one of the most important variables, one of the most important factors that you have to consider. I think they're going to look for someone between 65 and, say, 72 years of age, so late 60s, early 70s. And if the Pope lives another 5 years, you know, there's a number of people who will go out of that window of opportunity, and younger ones that will, you know, start to get into that window.
Why is age so important? Are you trying to split the difference? You don't want someone to stick around too long and get too entrenched, and you don't want someone too old, right?
I think that's exactly part of the reason. If we look at the 20th century, the average age of popes elected in the 20th century was 65. John Paul II was the youngest. John the 23rd was the oldest. So, you know, I think, you know, 65 would be probably around the youngest they might select. On the other hand, you know, you don't want a pope who's too old. I mean, we've had now a number of years of an elderly, sick pope. Do we want to elect another pope who's elderly and in a couple of years gets sick and we have this all over again? You know, that's why I think that they would look towards someone in their late 60s and early 70s. The average age of the College of Cardinals, the cardinals who will actually meet, in fact, will be 72 years of age.
Have you met John Paul II? Have you had an audience with the Pope?
Not a private audience with the Pope, but I've been at audiences with the Pope. I spent 9 months over in Rome when I was doing my research for my book Inside the Vatican.
Did you get a sense of the Pope's charisma?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is a Pope that has really knows how to communicate and how and has been very successful. I mean, his background as an actor and as a teacher, I think, really served him well as Pope. He knows how to handle an audience. He knows how to interact with them, and he thoroughly enjoys it. And he's energized by it. I mean, you can almost see when he went to Toronto. I mean, he was just totally energized by his interaction with the young people in Toronto.
Father Thomas Rees, I really appreciate talking to you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Father Thomas Rees is the editor of America, the National Catholic Weekly magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of The Dying Animal, the new paperback by Philip Roth, author of American Pastoral. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former fire commissioner of New York City, Thomas Von Essen. He led the department through the September 11th attacks and the rescue and recovery. He has a new memoir, Strong of Heart. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.